Yeah, so I thought the first thing I'd ask is maybe you can give us a bit of background. You know, you're obviously a parent, you're a media mogul in some people's eyes, entrepreneur, financier, you know. So what of that recipe drove your interest in education? How did you get involved?
I went to my first education reform conference 45 years ago. I was in college. Was out on the plains in Manhattan, Kansas.
Wow.
And there was a student group called the National Student Association that was kind of running a training program for student leaders on how they might go about reforming their university educational programs. And I was smitten immediately with the whole idea that schools could be better, and that we didn't have to just accept the old plan, if you will. And in college, that was I spent a lot of my energy and time on that. And then for the 20 years immediately after college, I was in the media business, so I wasn't working on education reform matters, but then I returned to it about 20 years ago with the founding of Edison Schools, and you know, we were one of the early pioneers in the world of charter schools. So it's been a big part of my life, and Avenues is I think of Avenues as chapter 3 in my last professional chapter, if you will. So,
thinking back about, you know, you mentioned being smitten at this conference, and thinking back to the education you enjoyed and or maybe tolerated, depending on how you look at it, and your kids. How have those experiences, you know, formed your views of Edison and now Avenues? You know, what have you picked up from that and said, oh, you know, this has got to change or this is good? You know, what have you picked up from that?
It's really a good question because there's no question that both my own experiences and that of my children have impacted the way I think about this, and I'm sure that's true of anybody that's excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold, that is in the movement today. In terms of how my own educational experience is impacted, I think that very early on, and I don't think this was by design, I think it was dumb luck on my part. The schools that I went to, and I went to public schools, both K-12 and at the college level, for some reason, they allowed me a tremendous amount of freedom to pursue things that I cared about, and you know, I was released from kind of conventional class all through high school and all through college, and I think one of the things I took away from that is that allowing children and students to pursue independent work, it leads to all sorts of lessons that are not, you know, your conventional classroom lessons. And for example, I think my entrepreneurial skills grew out of the fact that I was allowed to kind of start things when I was in high school and college. And a big part of what we're trying to do at Avenues is to allow students to have a degree of independence to pursue things they care about. The second thing is that my family life has, I mean, you know, I grew up small town in Tennessee, am a monoglot through and through and through. can barely read anything.
Oh,
pardon?
Oh, okay.
You know, I had my 2 years of Spanish, my 2 years of French, but you know, I can maybe get through a menu. All of my wife is from Italy, and she speaks four languages, and one of the things she made sure of is that our children spent a couple of years overseas during their high school days, actually, and they all grew up bi or trilingual, and I saw the impacts of just their kind of worldview from that, and so in some respects that has been baked into to what we're doing at Avenues as well.
So you said Avenues, where students have a degree of independence. What does that mean?
An easy way to describe it is if you look at our, I'll tell you a story. When we designed the architectural aspects of the school, we invited a number of headmasters, heads of schools, to come review our architectural drawings, just kind of peer review, and just give us their reactions. And one of the reactions was is that we had half as many classrooms as we needed. And I said, "That's right. That's exactly the design. We took the other half away, and we provided instead large areas in the school where students can work either in small teams or are on their own." And so if you were to come into our high school, it's not if you think of the high school you went to and every other high school just about, there was a long hallway and there were classrooms on both sides of it. Essentially, there's classrooms on only one side of our hallway, and the other side is independent work areas for kids. And so they spend half as much time in conventional classrooms as you would typically see in a high school.
So does that mean that they have directed work during that time, or does it mean that it's, you know, the Google 25% of your own time to do whatever you want, in theory, which isn't really the case, but how does that play out?
We don't view that as, I mean, it's not do whatever you want. I mean, it's monitored, it's mentored, and supported. But it is, you might be doing a course online that may have been of your and your advisor's choosing. You might be doing a team project that you and a group of other students had decided that you wanted to do in science or in math. You might be using that time for research or reading. So it's work time. But one way we think of it is we think of it, it's much more like college than it would be high school.
Looking back at the larger, let's say, reform efforts you've made, you know, today, here we are, 2012. I mean, I have a daughter in college and one in high school, and been involved in these things for 9 years, I guess. And it's remarkable to me how little has really changed, even in my short time. You know, and you have a longer arc of experience. You talk about Edison and Avenues, but today, across at least the U.S. public education landscape, a very small percentage of kids have any sort of choice or, let's say, a non-traditional option, non-assembly line option. So why is that? You know, you have the experience, so why are we stuck in the mud largely as a society?
By the way, you were breaking up slightly. Oh. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Yeah, just great. I'm on Skype. Yeah.
I think I caught everything, but I just wanted to double check.
Sure.
First of all, I agree with you. I'll even raise you a little bit. I think if you look at a 20-year arc, it unfortunately, what you just said, I think holds true for that 20-year period as well. And in private sessions with colleagues that have been in this for that stretch of time and even longer, you know, we all remark on, in many ways, on the disappointment of how far things have or have not come. And why that is, I think it's multiply determined. We often all forget how enormous the public education sector is, and that, you know, roughly 20% of the entire population of the United States is involved in it daily, which is, if you include the students and the staff, and, you know, it's in the zone of 60 million people, and it's, you know, that's the population of France, and so you go, this is not an easy ship to turn, and that's one thing. The second thing is that, what school is, and I use that as a phrase, is almost imprinted on all of us. And there was, you know, 15 years of imprinting that occurred, that this is school, and that it's, you know, it starts in September, it ends in May. It's divided into six parts each day. There's a teacher with a group of some number of kids in a classroom, and on and on and on. And to break down that that structure is remarkably hard, because it's so difficult to even imagine what the new world looks like because of how deeply that has been imprinted on all of us. So I think that's a second big factor. And then obviously there's a third, which is there are a lot of people that are quite happy with the way it is and would like to keep it that way. Many factors go into it, but this is not a this is not a short process that we're all involved in.
No. So given that, and again, given the entrepreneur experience, let's say, and the thing that strikes me about my observations, my close observations over the last 8-9 years, is that the organizations are afraid of failure, or I should say afraid of the perception of failure. And therefore the antibodies come out quickly, you know, regarding almost anything. And that's obviously very different from people who start things and are used to, you know, your initiative not working or the strategy changes or what have you. But, you know, you have you've sort of aimed in one direction with Edison, and then now you've gone, let's say, at the very high end with Avenues. You know, traditional disruptions often occur at the very low end, right? You know, they're beneath contempt. They're, you know, whatever they would be, you know. So have the reformers shot at the wrong target? I mean, that's one option.
You know, I did lose that question a little bit. Would you say that one again?
Sure. I mean, you've spent a lot of time on Edison and now Avenues, and especially Avenues is aiming at the very high end, you know. But traditional disruption, you know, across many industries, many organizations, occurs beneath contempt. You know, it's typically at the low end, right? It comes in and people say, oh, you know, and some might say Khan Academy or that sort of thing is like that today. You know, we'll see. But has Edison and Avenues, you know, have they been aimed at the right place?
Well, one, I would say innovation can occur at any part of the spectrum. And indeed, I would go a lot of innovation typically does occur at what you might view the high end. It trivializes it in some ways, but if you look in the whole world of technology, often innovation begins at relatively high price points, and then over time, people try to figure out ways to bring price points down. And example, if you look at, you know, large flat screen televisions, 5 years ago they were five times what they are today. I've always thought NASA was a similar example, that you know, so much of what we enjoy in technology today sprang from a lot of the work that, you know, was done at NASA, and obviously I would put NASA at the very high end of the spectrum.
Right.
When it comes to school reform, one thing I often say to people is that I think broadly there is one model of schooling worldwide, and I would also tell you I think there's kind of one model of schooling across both public and private sectors, and even across different price points, meaning you know, top private school education in the United States today is in the $30,000 to $40,000 per pupil zone. If you look at public education, it's on average, it's probably in the 10 to 12 zone. I'm a little dated on that. And so you would look at that and go, well, that's a very different model, where one is working with one third of the resources of the other. Interestingly, though, the resources are different. I don't think the models themselves are that different as they currently exist. And I've always been agnostic about where reform should occur. I go, if it occurs in the public sector or the private sector, I think the important thing is that we change it, and that where we change it first doesn't matter much, because I think once it gets in the water, it'll spread in all directions.
So then the secret reform lever, or the Ponce de Leon, you know, search for the golden reform strategy remains unknown. We're all still seeking it, it sounds like. So looking back again the last 20 years, What wins and losses are you most proud of, Chris?
It's very interesting that you combine.
Well, of course, that's how we learn, right?
No. It's very important. I find it impressive that you imagine you can take pride in your losses and your wins.
Of course.
And I've never heard it phrased that way.
Well, I've had some losses. Yeah.
I like the way you said that. I'm thinking.
You know, we can continue this again. You know, you said you have to go in about 9 minutes, so I have three more questions. But
three more questions. We can squeeze in. I mean, there's so. The reason I'm pausing, there's a rich number of choices in both categories of wins and losses. I would say on the win side, one that is right at the top is Edison and Avenues. I think understood very early on the importance of professional development in schools, and that professional development as being defined as arrive at school 2 days before school begins and will show you your classroom and give you your orientation. And then a couple of days during the year when outside speakers would come in, that was nowhere near what we needed. And I feel like all along the way we've done very good work in that area. I'll give you an example. One of the requirements for being a teacher at Avenues, we had 4,900 teachers apply for 120 teaching posts.
I saw that.
At the school. And when they would apply, we would say, you know, one thing we want you to know is that you won't have this summer off. And that we want to do several weeks of orientation and culture building and professional development, and so everyone needs to show up on July 1st, and it's made a huge difference in the way that we open school tomorrow, and you know, we open as a team and as a culture, and I would say that's a victory that we experienced in our Edison days as well. On the loss side of the ledger, where to begin? But I think very early, Edison was one of the first systems of schools to understand the potential for technology. Looking back, I mean, Edison was pre-internet, which
right.
was amazing.
Right.
And I think largely over the last two decades, there's been a failure to figure out how to bring technology into the brick and mortar world of schooling. And I can remember early on in Edison, where we said we're going to put four computers in every classroom, and the number of times I walked into classrooms and those four computers were sitting there at the back of the room.
Right, of course.
I remember that many times. On Friday, all of our ninth graders were arriving for their technology kind of orientation, and each of them received an Apple laptop and an iPad, and I was looking at the immense difference of what can be done now versus then, and I think though it's that area has been disappointing over the last 20 years, I think we're about to see that come into its own in a huge way. So those are two.
Okay. That's a good start. So if you were 18 today, what would you do, knowing what you have learned and then obviously seeing your kids? What would you study? What would you do?
Well, I have no idea, as I had no idea then. I do know one thing I would do differently that I didn't understand then, and I would. And obviously that's a big question that we could go on, but I know I would do language very differently. But by the way, the important thing maybe is what would I have done as a parent differently? And I think making sure that my children had very early language acquisition programs, and in fact, thanks to my wife, that did happen. But I don't think I understood the importance of that, and it's something. Language is something you need to get on very early, and because that's the easiest time to acquire.
Agreed.
And I know I would do that differently. At 18, you basically missed the window.
Right.
And that's too harsh, but you've missed the best window. Mm-hmm.
But you know, I guess a bit more specific on that. Would you still pursue, let's say, more a traditional education, or would you? You know, focus more on, let's say, sciences or the underpinnings of technology today, or, you know, would you say most people should just go get a liberal arts degree as we've done for many decades? So, you know, what's your sense of that?
Two things. I think. If we could think of education in two buckets, we'd broadly be better off. One bucket is a content bucket, mm-hmm. where that there actually is a benefit in understanding the arc of human events and history. Understanding basics in mathematics and reading and science. And then the other bucket is a set of skills about, it's the whole idea of learning how to learn. But it's more than that. It's learning how to conduct a life, and I think schools of the future will think more and more that way, if I had known what I know today, I would try to organize my own education that way. So.
Okay. And then the last question, looking ahead. So you've taken another deep dive in the system with avenues. You know, 5-10 years from now, what would make you smile and proud from that initiative?
If in most of the great cities of the world, there was an Avenues campus that was viewed in the city that it was in as one of the finest educational options in that city, but was also viewed as deeply connected to its sister campuses worldwide. And one of the things we're deeply involved as we speak in preparing our campuses in Beijing and in São Paulo, Brazil, and in London, which are our next three sites. And I'm in Beijing every month, and my partner's in Brazil every month. And one of the things we realize is the collective intelligence of an organization, an educational organization that spans many different cultures, is a much richer collective intelligence, and that in some ways I view this as the educational equivalent of cloud computing, and that. All of these campuses collaborating just winds up being a better milieu for the students and the faculty within. So, and we have a pretty clear picture of what we want to be a decade from now, and it's an exciting time for us. So,
great.